You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. This Sunday is the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. It's also now a National Day of Service and Remembrance. In honor of that, an interfaith group of religious leaders in the Champaign area and their congregations are coming together to help construct two homes with Habitat for Humanity. It's the most recent interfaith habitat project in Illinois. Others have taken place in Springfield and in Lake County. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with three of the leaders of the Champaign effort from the First Mennonite Church, the Sinai Temple, and the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. But first, I want to welcome Sheila Dodge. She's the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity in Champaign County and in studio with us. Sheila, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What's the significance of starting this project this Sunday on the anniversary of September 11th? It's a ceremonial kickoff, right? Because the actual building is going to start next month.
Correct. National Day of Service is, like you said, in honor of those who lost their lives at 9/11. And then through that terrible tragedy, everybody came together through service and unity. And so we thought it would be a nice way to honor that here locally.
And Habitat for Humanity is a Christian-based faith organization. But for this project, it's also celebrating your 25th anniversary. You reached out to other faith groups in the area. Why was that important for you guys to do?
It has been important, an effort that we've tried to do for several years. My very first project I did when I started at Habitat was with the Mennonite Church, and they said they would like to do this work with other congregations, and just for a variety of reasons, now is the time that it's happening. So that's very exciting for us. We reached out to over 100 different faith organizations throughout the county, and we have 22 who have signed on board to do this effort with us.
Can you tell us a little bit about the 22? Who are the different groups that are going to be taking part?
We have obviously these three at the table, and then we have some Lutheran churches and Methodist churches. And I don't have the list in front of me, but yeah, we have a wide variety.
Now, are those mostly Christian, Jewish, and Muslim groups, or are there other faith communities also involved with the effort?
No, mostly Christian.
And how many homes are you going to be building?
We're going to be building two.
And how long will it take to build the homes?
Typically, it takes us about 16 weekends, but we're going to do a concentrated effort for 2 weeks to actually get the house under roof. So we'll be doing the first home the week of October 18th, and the second home will be the week of October 25th. And then we'll let them sit a little bit, let the faith groups continue to do fundraising, and then have our subcontractors involved. And then we will come back in the spring and finish them up then.
And for people who aren't familiar with Habitat for Humanity, can you explain who the families are who are going to be getting the houses and how that process works?
Yep. We have two families. To qualify, you have to meet three criteria. You have to have a housing need. You have to be willing to partner. So I'm sure these two families will be meeting with all 22 of these groups at some point or another. And then you have to be able to pay the mortgage, because when the projects are finished, we do sell the homes to the families.
And those families are also involved in the effort as well.
That's right. They have to do 250 hours of sweat equity, and most of that will be on their build sites. So they'll be there as much as they possibly can through the builds.
And I don't know if those families attend any congregations, or if those congregations, maybe if they attend, are going to be part of the effort to build the house?
Right now, they do not attend any that I'm aware of.
Now, I think one interesting thing about this was you all had to adjust the typical schedule of building and working to respect every faith's day of rest. How did you end up getting everybody on a schedule that works out for them?
I just have a great team that's very flexible. They're very excited about working with this group, and they're willing to rotate and flex their schedules around so that they're anxious to meet and partner with them, but also work with the different groups.
And if other people want to be involved in this effort, if they're not part of a faith community, how can they get involved?
I would suggest they go to our website, cuhabitat.org. and contact Kim Gollings, who is our volunteer manager.
And we'll tweet out those links as well if you follow 21st Show. I want to thank Sheila Dodd, Executive Director with Habitat for Humanity Champaign County, for joining us. I want to welcome three more people who are also in studio with us right now and are involved in the effort. Pastor Michael Crosby of the First Mennonite Church in Champaign, Rabbi Alan Cook from the Sinai Temple, also in Champaign, and Iman Osman Sawadogo from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. Gentlemen, thank you for being with me today, too.
Thank you so much for having us.
Rabbi, you were involved with Interfaith Communications for a few years now. I know you're the head chair of the Interfaith Alliance Group in Champaign-Urbana, especially as we're thinking about kicking this off on September 11th. Why do you think it's important for your congregation to be involved with in other faith groups?
I think in general, there is an attitude, unfortunately, in this country nowadays, that we have to stick with our own and we have to be afraid of those who look or feel or appear or believe to be other than us. And I, particularly in my work and in my faith tradition, want to explode that notion and show the congregation and show the community that we can work together and partner together. There's nothing to be afraid of from these two gentlemen that are sitting in the studio with me. There's nothing to be afraid of from people who may behave or look differently from you. And one of the reasons I think that fear has arisen and taken root in our country is because of a lack of understanding and a lack of opportunity to get to know others. And so if we can partner together on a wonderful project like this, make a positive change in our community as a side effect of this work, then perhaps we can see the innate humanity in each individual and really begin to break down some of those barriers.
Imam, Pastor Michael, both of you, your congregations are actually pretty much almost across the street from each other, right? The Central Illinois Mosque and First Mennonite Church. How long? So I think just because of that proximity, have you all been working together just to share spaces and logistics for some time, Pastor Michael?
Sure, yeah. I think for about 15 years now, there have been a number of personal relationships and some shared space. Folks at CIMIC often park in our parking lot on Fridays for prayers. And there have been lots of opportunities, shared speakers who come to one or the other of our houses of worship. And we invite each other to these events and just try and share. We have a peace garden on the property at both of the houses of worship. And we've often come together in the fall for a harvest party. We share the produce and make food together out of that and eat together. And those have all been really meaningful interactions for us over the years.
And Mom, I know you've said that you feel like it's a very important part of Islam to get to know other faiths and learn about different opinions. What does it mean for you and for your congregation to be involved, not just as Pastor Michael saying, the efforts that you guys have done together, but also this interfaith build?
Yeah, for us, it's very important. And I said before, because knowing the other is part of our faith. And that the verse in the Quran, when the Quran says that God saying that we have created you, tribes and nations, so that you may know each other. So this is a requirement for us Muslims to go and know the other. And if there's no dialogue, you will not know the other. And the second thing that make it very important for us is that it come to what happened in 9/11. And we Muslims were aware that many people don't make this difference between this small minority of people who committed this horrible act and the vast majority of Muslims. Some people even call us and say that you're not talking against what is happening. We've been talking, but many people maybe they don't hear our voice. So this is a very good opportunity for us to come and do something. And also, there's a verse in the Quran when God is saying that help each other, support each other in what is good and what is righteous. Do not help each other in what is bad and evil. So here, that's a very good thing, and we are required by our religion to support that and participate.
And Imam, the people within your congregation, I know that being on the university campus, there's a lot of opportunity for people who are international students and maybe people who don't have as much chance to interact with other members of the Champaign area community, other than apart from the mosque, perhaps, mm-hmm. and then these interfaith activities. Do you feel like that becomes something really important for your congregation then to spend time with other people outside of the university community?
Yes, it is very important because we have students or community members who are coming from countries where the only religion is Islam. So these people are really did not have a chance to interact with people from other faith communities. So it is very important for us to have to be engaged in this interfaith alliance and any interfaith activity, and sometimes even bring these activity to the masjid so that those people who do not have the chance to interact with other people get the chance to talk to the people of other faith. And one of the examples of that is what happened yesterday in the mosque when we had this interfaith dinner about
last night. All three of you were together at a dinner, and it was at the mosque.
Yes, it was at the mosque, and many people were very happy because it was their first time to talk to other people from other faith community.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi, what was that experience like yesterday evening for you all?
It was fabulous for me. We had about 10 congregants along with me from Sinai Temple, many of whom had never set foot in any mosque before, let alone in Simic. I was able to bring my 10-year-old son with me, and I think that was very eye-opening and important for him and for me. The more that we can educate our children who are not born with these prejudices in the idea of embracing others and recognizing, again, the beauty and the love that is inside each human being, the more that we can, again, break down those barriers and build a community of faith and of peace.
Rabbi Allen, do you feel in a way because of, as you mentioned, sort of the divisive language that we've heard so much, especially unfortunately during this presidential campaign and this election year, about different people of different faiths and different different immigrants. Do you feel like, is there any hesitation on the part of folks within your congregation to reach out? Or maybe just the fear of the unknown, as you said, also having never, for Jewish congregations, never stepped inside a mosque before. And most people probably, I imagine, who aren't Muslim haven't been inside of a mosque.
Sure. And I imagine that there are people in this community who have never set foot inside the synagogue before. And I think that, you know, the more that we can throw open our doors and break down some of those barriers, the better that it is. I have not heard any of my members articulate any discomfort. I think that probably it does feel like a risk or a courageous step whenever we venture into something that is previously unknown to us. But I hope that the message that we are sending is one of, try it out. There's no harm in trying it out. And these people of the various different faiths or races or what have you are our neighbors. They work alongside us. They live alongside us. And so why shouldn't we learn to live together in harmony?
Do you have a lot of students in your congregation as well?
We have a religious school that's about 100 students, and we are working, again, to teach them about comparative religions and about valuing each other.
As we talk about school, Pastor Michael, how much awareness have you done with your congregation? How much a part of just the church's curriculum has been maybe learning more about Islam or Judaism?
Well, a lot of the interest comes not just from my presentation, but from folks in the congregation who really are always thrilled to be invited to be a part of anything happening at the temple or at the mosque. So we've had a couple of Sunday school classes in the last years. Some years ago, when I first arrived at the Mennonite Church, there was a partnership with some folks at the mosque. They were doing a joint Sunday school class around earth care issues and environmental questions. More recently, we've had some education on interfaith opportunities, and a professor of Islamic studies from the university came and presented, and Rabbi Allen was there 1 week as well and did some presentation and also made an invitation to us to come and join Sinai for a Shabbat service, which many of us did. So I think for me, as a representative of a Christian denomination here at the table, part of what's important is simply to acknowledge how grateful we are whenever we have the opportunity or an invitation to be invited into these spaces and learn something about our Jewish and Muslim sisters and brothers. That's just such a privilege for us. It's always such an honor to be welcomed in that way.
Are there any plans as you all, as you start the build and you begin to do work together, you mentioned, are there any plans for your congregations to attend each other's services, religious services?
I certainly hope so.
And when you all are doing how many people from your congregations will be involved in the actual effort? Pastor Michael, how many folks do you think how big of a group do you think you'll be having?
Probably somewhere between 10 and 12. I think it's a little limited in this because there are so many faith groups involved. We've each been kind of allotted a very particular number of people. And so we're all contributing volunteers. And one of the goals right from the start, I know Habitat presented it this way, and all of the faith volunteers agreed.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. We're talking about an interfaith effort that has its ceremonial kickoff on Sunday, September the 11th, the National Day of Service and Remembrance. We have three of the religious leaders from Champaign County who are involved with this Habitat for Humanity interfaith build in studio with me, Rabbi Alan Cook from the Sinai Temple, Iman Osman Sawadogo from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center, and Pastor Michael Crosby from the First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana. Pastor Michael, you were just saying before the break how many people that you were going to have involved. I know with Habitat Builds, has your church done Habitat Builds in the past?
We have. We partnered with Habitat several times. And in those cases, we were doing it sort of exclusively as our own project as a congregation. And so we contributed all the volunteer labor. One of the things that Habitat stressed right from the start with this interfaith project is wanting to get kind of an even number of volunteers from every faith community involved, and to schedule it so that those volunteers could mix up together. So I know, at least in the first instance, for the part of the build that happens this fall, we've been asked to contribute 5 volunteers for a particular day, and they'll be paired with 5 volunteers from several other houses of worship on that day and have an opportunity to mix together and meet each other. When we've done these builds as a congregation in the past, one of the most meaningful parts of the work for us is the way that we come together as a congregation and get to know each other better. This is part of doing work and service. And the way that we strengthen our connection to the community, we get to know the family who's purchasing the house that we're working on, and that's an important part of Habitat's work too. So I think in broadening that to interfaith work, we're really excited about that same kind of connection building that can happen in doing service together.
Well, as someone who's worked on many Habitat projects myself, there's nothing like bonding with someone when you're putting up drywall or carrying lots of very heavy, I think the last time I remember carrying lots of grass that was really, really heavy. Rabbi, I wonder for you all how this might be different than other service projects that your congregation might be involved with. If this is a newer experience, if this is your first Habitat project as well, but I'm sure there's lots of other service projects your congregation has been involved
with. This is the first Habitat project that I've been involved with in this community, and I think probably the first that Sinai Temple has been involved with for a long time. But Judaism places a strong value on community service, as I know all of our faiths do. And you know, as Pastor Michael said, we will have to see when we put out the call who wants to engage in what days. But one of the things that I also appreciate about the Interfaith Build is that they are looking beyond just the sweat equity at how we can bring these different congregations together. Different congregations are being asked to provide food during the build days and so forth to help communicate our cultural differences and our cultural similarities. And I hope that we'll bond with the families that are going to own these homes and that we'll be able to bond with one another. One of the values that Judaism places on community service is that, yes, anonymous giving is valued, but it's also nice to know who is going to be the beneficiary and the recipient of this good work. And so to be able to work alongside the families that are going to be living in these houses, I think is going to be a very special feeling.
Imam, I think oftentimes when we think about interfaith things, oftentimes it's like a worship service where people come together. I think Thanksgiving has been traditionally a place where you have one Thanksgiving worship service where lots of different faith traditions can come and be together. How do you think this will be different for your congregation to be in a community effort that's apart from any kind of religious observance or worship?
Yeah, for some community members, this will be the perfect thing because many of them believe that interfaith activities has to be in charity, helping the other. That's better than having interfaith prayer together for some of the community members. It doesn't matter for those who think like that or those who say that no, interfaith should be should include everything, worship and community service. I have the feeling that many people are very excited. Many people talk about that, but until now I don't have the confirmation that they will attend, but I believe that many people are excited.
One last question for anyone who wants to jump in. And Rabbi, I feel like you've answered this already, but we started this conversation about the fact that this is on September 11th. This is Remembrance Day. This is a national day of service. This is traditionally a time now in this country over the past 15 years where this has been an opportunity for interfaith efforts. I wonder if you think, as we're thinking about 15 years of the anniversary of September 11th, and also as we've talked about the tone of national conversation that's happened over this year, Pastor Michael, I wonder how important you think this year's interfaith efforts will be.
Well, I certainly hope that this is an inspirational project as much as anything else, that this is simply an opportunity to show how beautiful it can be when we get to know each other. Both the rabbi and the imam mentioned the importance of getting to know the other, and we discover in that process that the other is actually not so other as we might have assumed. The other looks a lot more like us. In my tradition, it's common to talk about looking for the face of God in the stories of others. And so this is about sharing stories. And in the first instance, we have different stories, but this is about even creating some common stories with each other. And I hope that has a lot of power.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's Pastor Michael Crosby with First Mennonite Church of Champaign-Urbana. I want to thank also Rabbi Alan Cook from Sinai Temple and Iman Usman Sawadogo from the Central Illinois Mosque and Islamic Center. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
We'll tweet out links, by the way, to that Habitat conversation if you follow 21st Show. If you want to get involved with that, we'll have all that information. If you've got kids who are Lego fans or if you're a Lego fan yourself, there's an exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry you might want to check out. It's called Brick by Brick, and it features creations by Lego certified professional Adam Reed Tucker. We're going to be speaking with him in a few minutes about the collection he built of more than a dozen structures made entirely of Legos, which include a 60-foot-long Golden Gate Bridge, the International Space Station, the Roman Coliseum, and more. The exhibit also includes several different stations where kids can get hands-on experience with Lego design challenges. One of our producers, Christine Herman, went to check it out and brought us back this audio postcard.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our Brick by Brick Design Challenge. If anybody else wants to join us, come on down. We're starting right now. What we're going to do in the next 10 minutes, we're going to be thinking like architects, engineers, and designers, and we're going to build a solution to a real-world challenge using only Lego bricks.
Do we have any volunteers?
All right, I saw your hand shoot right up and your hand shoot right up. Come on up, you guys. Welcome, everybody. Give a hand to our designers. We're going to build something to help you explore another planet. Taylor, what's an example of another planet?
Let's
excellent.
Is the moon count?
Well, the moon is, it's in space, right?
Yeah.
That we can we definitely want to explore the moon. Yes, so it's not quite a planet, but it's related to our planet, so we can go with it.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, we have 3.5 minutes starting in 3, 2, 1, go. All right, so Legos are flying everywhere. They are building something to help us explore another planet. Now, while they're designing, guys, let's do some designing of our own. So what's something we use right now to help us explore another planet?
Yeah.
A rocket ship. How does a rocket ship help us explore other planets?
So you can get to another planet.
You can get to that other planet. Definitely. That's a great example. Yeah, how about you?
Rovers.
Rovers. How do rovers help us?
They collect data and send them back to NASA.
Excellent. So, guys, so what do you want your rover to do?
I want it to be able to be to collect the most data and be able to do a lot on that planet.
Collect the most data. Excellent. Now, guys, if we were going to build ourselves a brand new rover, we're going to design the latest rover technology for NASA, what kind of features might you put into your rover?
I think that there should be, like, arms so that it can, like, scoop up things and basically take samples of foreign material.
So, designers, you've got about 20 seconds left. Go ahead and put the last bricks on your designs. We're going to count them down when we get to 10. Everybody loves a good countdown. You guys ready? 10, 9, 8, 7,
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
0. Last bricks on. Hands in the air, designers. Hands in the air. All right, we're going to start over here with Emily. Can you hold up your design? What did you build?
I tried to build a rocket ship, but there was, like, not a lot of parts to make it. The flames come out of here, and then you just fly away.
Can you hold up your design for me, buddy? What'd you make?
An 881 Roger Mars blaster.
A Mars blaster? You put so much thought into this.
Even a place where you put down your underwear so it doesn't float away.
You've got a place for your underwear. He's thinking about everything.
And a table so powerful that if you put food on it, it won't come off. And this also squirts out oxygen.
There's so much stuff in here. This is so functional. So give it up one more time for our master builders.
Thanks to Christine Herman for giving us a sense of that exhibit. It's on display at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago through February of 2017. We're joined now by Adam Reen Tucker, the LEGO-certified professional who built all of the structures inspiring those children at the museum. Hey, Adam, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
I feel like I have to start off by asking, what is a LEGO-certified professional and how do you become one? Because are there only 14 in the world?
There are only 14 in the world, yes. And how do you become one? The number one question that's asked of me anywhere I go. So the quick response to that would be that you have to be doing something with the Lego brick that the Lego group recognizes as pioneering new frontiers with the use of the Lego brick, not just as a toy. And you kind of get discovered, and then you get approached by Lego. I believe you can apply now, but yeah, essentially you have to be doing something that's creative and that the company is not already doing.
I should mention, Adam, you're a Chicago native. You're on the line with us from Chicago. How were you discovered?
So back in 2006, I did an exhibit in Washington, D.C., and I wanted to tell the story of how the Twin Towers from 9/11 collapsed using a model to convey so people could understand what happened that day, that fateful day. And so I was able to use Lego bricks as a way of making an 8-foot-tall model. And that's really how I got discovered.
Wow. And it's interesting. It must be interesting for you to think about that as we're thinking about this weekend, the 15th anniversary of the towers collapsing. Do you feel like that was an opportunity for you to take that tragedy and actually use it as an opportunity? It sounds like for kids to even, or anyone, to learn a little bit more about engineering.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that was 15 years ago, obviously, and we lost, you know, over 3,000 lives that day and 343 first responders. And being in Chicago, obviously New York was not alone, and we did not want to have them feel that they were alone that day, as many people from across the country and that world came out to Ground Zero. And what I wanted to do in my own small little way here in Chicago was let the world know that we lost a lot of great buildings that day that obviously symbolized lower Manhattan. And so what I wanted to do was, instead of, you know, my son one day learning about the tragedies of 9/11 and seeing two of these great buildings out of 12 that are no longer with us in a textbook, I wanted to bring them to life in a model form. And so so that was really what inspired me, was to teach people about architecture engineering and using 9/11 as a platform to convey to the world that tall architecture is not anything to be fearful of. You know, at the time, the Empire State Building and the Sears Tower alike were losing tenants and, you know, tourism. And so I wanted to kind of tell the world that, hey, these buildings are something we should be proud of and not be fearful of. So.
And there, yeah, thank you for that, because as I were thinking about the structures that you built for the Brick by Brick exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry, there are 13 of them. How did you decide which ones to pick? Was that something you were allowed to do? Did the museum kind of give you suggestions?
Yeah. Well, actually, when we first started the talk about 3 or 4 years ago, I wanted to go from my first exhibit that they housed was on tall buildings or vertical architecture, skyscrapers. And then I wanted to tell the story of like horizontal engineering, which would be bridges. And they thought that maybe that was a little too focused for the Science Museum. And we wanted to maybe revisit it. And so we talked about doing modern marvels of engineering. And then that opened up into maybe ancient marvels of engineering. And so we wanted to tell the story of world historic engineering structures. So we have everything from, you know, the Roman Colosseum and the pyramids of Giza, all the way to Freedom Tower in New York and roller coasters and all sorts of Hoover Dam. And yeah, so we're kind of, it was a collective effort between Museum of Science and Industry and myself about what we felt would be good eye candy for the visitors and then unique stories to tell within the structures themselves.
Well, and Adam, I should point out that this is a legitimate Lego structures. They're made from tens of thousands of Legos. There's no glue. There's no other structural supports in anything that you built, right?
Yeah, there is, in full disclosure. So as an architectural artist, using the Lego brick as my creative medium, I want to tell an authentic story using the bricks, because I can't be an inspiration to those young or young at heart, because I want people of all ages to enjoy my creations, not just kids. And in order to do that, if I use special elements or special techniques or glue or steel structures inside, then that's not much of a motivation or inspiration to someone else who maybe doesn't have those resources. So what I do is I basically say any part that you can get in any Lego set off of any shelf in any toy store, you can build this too if you have enough pieces. Now, in this exhibit, because it's on display for a year, we did have to take some insurance measures. So some of the buildings, for instance, the Golden Gate Bridge is 60 feet long, and it actually works like a real bridge. But 10 feet away, we have an earthquake shake table. And we were afraid that over the course of a year, it's shaking 100 times a day, that maybe the parts would start to vibrate loose. So we put some clear supports under, you know, parts of the bridge just to ensure its integrity. But yeah, everything is built with no tricks, no glue. And that way I can be an inspiration for those that walk through the exhibit and say, hey, I can do that myself.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Adam Reed Tucker. He's a Chicago native. He's one of 14 people in the world who are Lego certified professionals. He's talking to us about the structures that he built that are all on display at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry. Stay tuned. Oh, by the way, we tweeted out some pictures of Adam's work. So if you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, you can see some of those pictures. We'll have them up on our website as well at www.21stshow.org. Stay tuned. We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute or two. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. We've been talking about Legos with a Lego certified professional. Yes, that is a thing. There are only 14 of these people in the world. One of them is Chicago native Adam Reed Tucker. He constructed more than a dozen massive structures for the Brick by Brick exhibit at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry. That exhibition is on display through February of 2017. Adam, as you were talking about the Golden Gate structure right before we took a break, and that's made of 64,500 Lego bricks of that particular one?
Your numbers are probably more accurate than mine.
Okay.
I don't recall, but it's a lot.
And how do you go about doing that? You have a background in architecture. Is this something, do you use a computer assisted design program to come up with your design before you build it?
That's a great question. So my personal process is, I try not to use computers at all. I do everything a scratch-built process, and I do it in my mind. So I just tinker a lot, and I do a lot of study models. It's really hard to do something like a 60-foot-long bridge in a computer. It would be helpful because it would tell me what parts I would need and how many, but my process is really more visceral. It's in my hands. It's trial and error. And I do some minor sketching just to get my proportions right, things like that. But typically, I'm just on the floor with parts, and I just start clicking them together.
Wow. And how long did that take?
So the different models can average 3 months to a few weeks, depending on the complexity and the you know, how involved they are and how many pieces. And the bridge, for instance, was only erected the first time in the museum itself because it's so long.
Mm-hmm.
In my studio, the longest spot I have is 40 feet. And since it's a suspension bridge, the cables, the whole thing needs to be built at the same time. I can't build it in sections. So that was a unique afternoon to see if it was really going to stand up at the museum. Fortunately, it did.
Great. We started this conversation by listening to some kids building things with the Legos. When you were listening to that before you and I started talking, I wonder if that reminds you of how you first discovered the possibilities of architecture. Was it through Lego?
Yeah, I think when I was three or four, I think my parents gave me some Lego sets for birthday or holiday, Christmas gift, whatever it was. And it was before I could like read instructions, but I was able to look at the picture on the box and build. And they thought, okay, you may have an aptitude for doing something like this. And so, yeah, I studied art and architecture and engineering in school. But, you know, when I was a kid, I just played with Lego, and I hadn't touched the brick for 25 years as an adult. And now it's just trying to break that stigma that it's a child's toy. It can be something to create with and play with or build with, theorize with. It's all the mindset, you know. So I've been quoted as being a 35-year-old Lego-playing kook about 10 years ago because there was just a lot of ignorance about, hey, why can't you take something and repurpose it as a professional adult? And so that's what I've been, that's my mission for the last 10 years. And through the exhibit brick by brick, hopefully when one walks through there, they don't instantly recognize the pieces as being built out of Lego until they get about a foot away. And then they're like, oh my gosh, that's all Lego. Wow. You know, it's not something you just have to play with as a child. Of course, that's what it's marketed for, and that's wonderful, and that's great, and that's where everyone should start. But as you go through the life cycle of adulthood, you can change the bricks to be whatever you want them to be, you know. So that's what I'm doing.
Thanks for talking to us. Lego certified professional and artist Adam Reed Tucker from Chicago talking to us about this exhibit. Adam, thanks for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
We thought we would broaden out the conversation now to explore the impact that toys can have on children, how they can influence their interest in careers like science and engineering, and how the way they're marketed can affect children's perceptions of their own abilities and even their gender identity. We're joined now by Isabel Cherney. She's the Dean of the School of Education and Social Policy at Merrimack College in Massachusetts. Professor Cherney, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
And we're just hearing Adam talk about playing with Legos in that exhibit and sort of his, you know, as how he sort of first discovered the possibilities of his career as a child playing with that. How much does actually play with brick by brick, hands-on activity, design challenging, how much does that actually truly help children develop an interest in science and engineering or technology or math?
It's a great question, and one that actually my team has been pondering for a while. And the research seems to indicate that there is really a direct correlation between what you play when you're a child and how your interests evolve over time. And so playing with the bricks, and I'm one of these children who played with the primary color bricks. I loved it. you know, develop spatial skills, develop this hands-on, innovative, creative way of looking at the world. And I see Adam's architectural prowess in building those, and really applaud him by retaking something that's really basic and making it this wow factor and thinking of, oh, I can build this, and there's no gender attached to that piece.
Well, and I think it's interesting because I'm also the generation that there was only one Lego set, and I had a big one, but it was just primary colors. When there weren't the kits that you see on toy store shelves these days, when did Lego start doing gender branding with their sets?
So they started the sort of pinkification, if I can say that, in the late 1970s. And then went sort of, you know, I think they probably thought it would be a good idea to engage the girls. It's half of the population, and maybe we can expand the market. And sort of went the way of, well, girls really like to play together with little dolls and like to do things that are nurturing. Therefore, we're going to build something that appeals to them because they prefer playing with this. And so over the last 3 years, you have started to see a change, though. So in the last 20 years, really, before that, there was kind of that, you know, let's do a little princess, the Belleville kind of standalone princess in the 1994, I think it came out. And then you see the Lego Friends coming out, but they were pink, they were purple, and if you ever went to a Lego store, you see one aisle is just pink and purple, and everybody else is actually playing with the much more vibrant colors and more interesting type of building sets.
Mm-hmm. We'll and tweet so, out right. There's an article that's describing this timeline you're talking about. It's from Public Radio International. We'll tweet that link out if you follow us on 21st Show. I want to ask about, there was a bit of a backlash, not just from parents, but from, I know, from feminist bloggers, from people within the STEM community, about how Lego was marketing to girls. And I wanted to ask about what's happening now, because now Lego's been making more efforts to not just do, for example, like the princess things that you were talking about, but the first female lab scientist minifigure, that came out actually in 2013. There's a research institute. There's other female empowering lines that Lego has, astronauts, scuba divers, having females represented among oceanographers and engineers. How important is that for children, girls and boys, to see those representations?
Absolutely. It is actually really important because then they can identify themselves as being one of these. And I like the fact that you said it's also for boys, because I think it's also important for boys to see that girls can have these types of jobs. Because early on they came out with just nurses and some very stereotypical types of professions. So that is outstanding. As a researcher, what I was seeing was, though, at some point was we want to do something, you know, that is that will expand our market, rather than thinking, what is it about Legos that would appeal to both genders, no matter what color, no matter how you build it. So I think the expanding those mini figurines to include scientists as women is great, but it's a first step. I think that Lego, with the Elves collection that they're coming out now, are on a better path. And I'm saying that because now they can build, now girls can also build certain structures. They can build sleighs and you know, they can build ships and magical hideouts and whatnot. Because at some point, the just mini figurines, you don't build necessarily. And I think what's really great about Legos is that it creates this imagination and passion and interest and creativity that comes with the building of the blocks. So I think I applaud them for having moved away a little bit from that you have to have a pink one and a blue kind of segregated type of marketing. So we're really starting to see it come all together. And in part, it was market driven. And as you said, there was some backlash.
There was backlash, and there were also other toys, right? Like, I'm thinking of the line of Goldie Blocks toys. Mm-hmm. Their goal, they say, is to get girls building. And on their website, they talk about how women are underrepresented in engineering. And so it seems like their approach is to make serious building toys designed just for girls, as they say, to disrupt the pink aisle. So do you think that approach is better, or how do we balance that with gender-neutral toys that encourage both boys and girls to build and design?
That, to me, is the way to go. So I've done 15 years worth of research with toys and gender and how boys and girls think about it and how they reason about it and how it makes them feel and the skills that they develop. So masculine toys that we call masculine toys are typical ones that develop spatial skills and construction and sort of science, and those are really important in that area. And girl toys or feminine toys tend to develop more sort of the domestic fantasy play and verbal skills and nurturing skills. All of those skills are important. And so it's both boys should develop more nurturing skills and verbal skills, and girls could move into the other side. What has been happening over time is that boys are typically not allowed to play with anything that's pink. And so what the toy manufacturers are doing, they're kind of compensating for those things. So you do see some dolls that are coming out for boys that are like Bob the Builder and so forth that young boys can have. And vice versa, you see superheroes and Goldilocks and others for girls to say it's okay to have scientific role models. Ultimately, I'm hoping that as a society we can move towards a more gender-neutral sort of way of looking at toys that would incorporate neither of the genders or both of them, so that it doesn't become taboo to go and play something if nobody watches. I really want to go and play with this one pink toy, or the other way around. So I think that's with toy manufacturers seeing, and Lego is a good example, that by designing something that is less stereotyped, suddenly it opens up all the markets for them.
Professor, we just have about a minute left, so I wonder if you could just answer briefly if Target making the decision last year to no longer have a boys and girls toy aisle, mm-hmm. and not separate, do you think that's then the future of what we'll start to see in more children's toys?
Yes, yes. And I think if online toy vendors would do the same thing, because now if you go in and you look for a toy, typically it's labeled for 3-year-old boys or for 4-year-old girls, etc. That would be also, there are some that are coming online where it is not about what age or what gender, but rather what is the function, what does the child like to play with, and that it is the interest that will then sort of sell the toy. And, play is a wonderful vehicle for children to learn. I mean, when they role play, for example, they create new rules, they negotiate roles, they use language and imagination, they substitute objects for other things, and they learn to reason and cooperate. All of that within, hours that they play each day. So having something that is less gender segregating would be ideal.
Thanks to Isabel Cherney. She's the Dean of the School of Education and Social Policy at Merrimack College in Massachusetts. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Everything is awesome.
Everything is cool when you're part of the team. Everything is awesome. That does it for this special encore edition of The 21st. Thanks for listening. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow that for the latest Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st. To like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Howla Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.